Hey, Jazz. Has anything cool, queer, or Jewish happened to you recently?
Sort of. All of my cool, queer, and Jewish things are happening online now, because that's the way the world works. But I've been doing daily Mishnah study with Svara, which has been very gratifying, and I really enjoyed it. And also, I got to connect a friend of a friend who's, like, the only Jewish trans person in his community to some resources, and that was really exciting.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and the other thing is that I've been doing Daf Yomi study still basically every day, and I had a friend I was trying to get to come to Mishnah study with me, and she was like, Jez, but there are so many strangers there. And I was like, well,
they're very friendly strangers.
They're very friendly strangers. We've been doing this together, which really has been lovely to get to be in that space with you.
Mm-hmm. You too, friend.
Yeah. And also then a bunch of my other friends are there. And sometimes I get texts being like, I saw you in Shior today and I liked the thing you said. And that's really nice. Anyway, the friend who I've been trying to get to come study with me was like, there are so many strangers and I won't do it yet. So I was like, okay, well, you could come hang out with me and Deco while we're studying. And so my friend Ava came and hung out with me and Deco, and that was really, really lovely. And I enjoyed that too.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So I have other things to talk about, but two really fun encounters through that Svara Mishnah study have been, I met Chava.
Yeah.
And she was like, I listen to your podcast. And I was like, I listen to your podcast. So hi, Chava. How are you? And then the other thing is, I kind of recognized somebody in today's study, and he, like, DM'd me, and I realized that this was a friend who I knew from Tumblr 5 years ago.
Whoa.
Because he had an Animorphs URL, and that was really cool.
That's great.
Yeah. And he was like, hey, you're in my contacts and stuff. And I was like, yeah, it's love. Even though I wasn't going by that name probably when we were mostly friends. Anyway, it was great. Yeah, he has a 9-year-old, which is really cool.
Whoa, that's so lovely.
Yeah. I think he referred to the kid as the spawn when they were like 3 or 4.
Sure.
So what's the difference between the Mishnah study and like the Daf Yomi cycle?
Mishnah's easier. Actually, like, very much so. Like, the other day, Deco and I opened a page of Torah and started going through it, and we were like, this is so much easier compared to the Daf Yomi stuff we've been doing. It's like we've been practicing with a weighted bat. So, okay, the way this works is that there's Tanakh, right? Torah is the 5 books of Moses, and then there's Nevi'im and Ketuvim. And so that's Tanakh, that's like the central text, and then Mishnah is a bunch of commentaries on that written by rabbis at a certain period of time, and then Gemara is commentaries on that written by more rabbis at a later period of time, and Talmud is a compilation of those people in conversation with each other and a bunch more commentators all around them from still later periods of history.
Good. So in the Daf Yomi cycle, that's 7.5 years through which you go through all of Talmud?
Yes, but I should kind of clarify that there's a lot of things on each page of Talmud. The way a page of Talmud, like a daf, is organized is a little bit like a spiral, or like, not a spiral exactly, but the things that are most centrally located on the page are also written in the biggest font.
It's like a political cartoon.
I don't know about that.
Okay.
But the things that are right in the center are the focus. So I guess in that, it does bear some resemblance to like art motifs, I guess.
Ha ha ha.
And we do that central column as much of it as we can get through. But all of the commentaries around it by people like Rashi and Tosafot and whatever, we almost never get to those. And those are written in a different script. It's the equivalent of changing from writing in like regular block letters to writing in cursive, except instead of moving to cursive, they're moving to what's called Rashi script.
Okay, Rashi.
This is not Rashi's fault. Rashi did not write in Rashi script.
Good. It's named that because he's the most prolific commentator and commentaries are put in Rashi script?
Yes, I think so.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Is Svara's study following any specific schedule that you know of?
You would probably have to ask them more specifically, but I believe they picked an interesting part of the Mishnah, and then we're just slowly going through that part of the Mishnah.
Cool. Because this is only lasting for like a month. We only have it scheduled through April?
I think it probably depends on how long we're in quarantine.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Speaking of, we'll see if it's still going on because this episode airs on the 16th of April.
Well, New York public schools, when I left New York, also I left New York, I'm in California now. New York public schools were scheduled to be closed through April 20th.
Okay.
But also, this is not strictly related, but while we're talking about things that are queer and Jewish in our lives, not the day this airs, but the day we're recording is a birthday of someone who I'm not in touch with anymore, but who was once a very, very dear friend of mine who is both queer and Jewish. And I've been thinking about, as the world seems to be changing, how we value the people who are no longer in our lives, but who were nevertheless important figures in our lives.
Yeah.
This friend was a complicated figure in my life, and there were good things and bad things, and also was one of the first people who I remember fully treating me as like one of the queer people in his life, even as I was like, I don't think I came out really until we were no longer in touch.
But like you were an honorary queer person.
Yeah, kind of. And part of the reason that that was so, the thing he said to me is because I was so, I think queer normative was the idea that he was used to people saying to him, do you have a girlfriend? And that was never a thing. Like when I met him, I was like, so are you dating anybody? You know, like it was like a different type of approach.
Set of assumptions.
So
that's really cool. Happy birthday to anonymous friend from the past.
Anyway, are we ready to get started?
What did I say before we started recording that I wanted to share with you?
That it was your birthday recently?
That hasn't happened yet when we're recording.
But it has when this episode airs.
Woo! I'm 29. I'm a grandmother.
Did you want to talk about Theo? Was that what you wanted to talk about?
That's it. Yes, thank you. So speaking of people from your past, social media-wise, my best friend is moving to Minneapolis. And instead of doing that in June, when they were originally planning, they're doing it now before things get worse. So on Tuesday, they will be staying with me for a couple days and then moving in with...
That's great.
Yeah. They were talking to me a little bit about that discussion that we had about when do you stay and when do you go pretty early on in this podcast.
Yeah.
Because they want to be near the people who they care about most in the world.
Yeah.
And felt really nice. And I'm going to be really glad to have my best friend living in the same city, even though I won't be able to see them after they leave my house for quarantine reasons.
Yeah.
I have one point of contact at any given time with other people. And currently that's Tova.
Yeah.
Anyway. Welcome to Kosher Queers, a podcast with at least two Jews and generally more than three opinions. Each week we bring you queer takes on Torah. They're Jazz.
And she's Lulav.
And today we're going to talk about Shemini.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, otherwise just known as eighth.
Which, confusingly enough, is not the eighth parsha of anything.
It's not, no, yeah.
Okay, so let's see how far into the parsha that word appears.
It's actually pretty close.
Yeah.
Vayahi bayom hashmini.
Oh, I was confused because there was a ha before it.
Yeah, that's just how Hebrew grammar works. It's just like, and there was in the day the eighth.
Good.
Yeah.
I'm so glad. So Jazz, I would appreciate 30 seconds. Does that seem foolhardy?
A little bit, but that's okay.
Give me 40.
that's what you said last time, apparently, because my timer is already set to it. Let's go.
Hashem and the Kohanim play a most dangerous version of Simon Says, ending when some of Aharon's sons incorrectly honor a miracle. After the corpse disposal, Moshe runs down appropriate food and drink for consumption within the Mishkan. In the process, he discovers that the Kohanim already burned the sin offering, rather than consuming the parts they were supposed to. Aharon argues with Moshe for the first time about halacha, and Moshe is happy about it. The rest is about which animals are kosher for all Israelites to consume and which are not. This also includes some confusingly worded instructions about how vessels and moisture play into things. I will definitely have to talk those out with you.
You had 3 seconds left.
Cool.
Nice job.
That's a very common thing. I have no idea how long things are going to take. But if I take my first incorrect estimate and then make an estimate based on the fact that it's incorrect, usually I'm pretty good. Not sure how that works.
That's delightful.
Yeah, so do you want me to just walk you on through this parsha?
Please. What is with the voice?
Well, come along, partner.
Stop!
We're all cowboys here.
Stop!
Okay. Wow, are you cowboy phobic?
Maybe a little bit. I have a very beautiful bolo tie, and I love that, and I think that Temple Grandin is kind of interesting, and that's like, and then, yeah, I guess there's some occasionally good gay cowboy stuff, but mostly, no.
That's like a very handsome accessory for you to have. Nice.
My parents bought it for me not long after I came out. They were like on a trip to New Mexico and they bought this bolo tie. It was like in colors that they knew I loved, like turquoisey. And they were like, look, you can wear it as like a tie, or if you buckle it lower, it's like a necklace and that seems really appropriate for you. So we got it for you.
That's really cool.
It's really cool.
So yes. On the 8th day of the ordination, so after it's all done and they're priests now, Moshe commands the priests and the people to bring 7 mammals for sin offering, burnt offering, and offering of well-being. He says this is because Hashem is appearing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big news, big day.
Big news, big day. Do you have any questions about this part?
I don't, but did you have anything you wanted to say about this part?
Not particularly. I said 7 mammals because it didn't seem to be that important which ones they were bringing, other than that it was, like, in accordance with the commandments for how Kohanim should act. So yeah, they do the thing at length, which is something we should be familiar with from the last couple episodes. Mm-hmm. Though, interestingly, it looks like even the writers get a little bored by verse 15, because they're just like, he presented it as a sin offering like the previous one.
Yeah. Thankfully.
Thankfully. So, to shake it up a little, at the end of chapter 9, God sends down fire and burns the entire burnt offering, mm-hmm. just like on the altar.
Yeah.
And everyone present goes, whoa! And rolls around on the ground like someone dropped a particularly hot couple bars during a cipher.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was not expected, and probably is not what's generally going to happen when they make a sacrifice at the Mishkan.
It's the first time God dropped down just to do a Shechianu to be like, we made it to this time, and then we'll never come back again, because you only do that the first time.
Remind me to tell you a Shechianu story after this.
Okay.
It's not appropriate for the normal podcast. So then Nadab and Abihu, 2 of Aharon's sons, are like, man, this is so cool. We have to commemorate this miracle. And so they take their censers or fire pans, depending on what translation you're reading, and they light fire in it and lay incense on it, and they offer it up to Hashem. Jazz, do you remember the part of Vayikra where the priests are told to do that?
Yes.
Uh-huh. How exactly are they supposed to offer up incense?
I don't remember. This is a test of my memory. How are they supposed to offer up incense?
You are so valid. They're supposed to offer it up on the bespoke incense altar, and they're only supposed to offer up the very specific holy incense.
Okay.
This is not what Nadab and Abihu are doing. And as a result, they get burned up by God herself.
Uh-huh. They sure do.
He's just like, I didn't say Simon Says, and just immolates them.
So two things. One is I did some reading and I have some translation notes for you.
Oh, yes, please.
But first, I want to see what you think. What is your take on this?
Yeah, my take is they weren't listening when Moshe told them what to do. Okay, so are you looking for like the it's all a hoax reading?
No, I'm looking for when you look at this and you go, wow, that's wild. What do you think they did? And also, how do you feel about it?
Oh, okay. So the thing that they did here is instead of offering incense through the proper channels of like going into the holiest place of the Mishkan and lighting God's preferred incense upon the specific table, they just took the censers that they were holding and wafted it up. And so this is an injunction against making sacrifices in a way that isn't like centrally approved, which now that I'm saying it out loud, I hate that because this is a way to concentrate contact with the divine in the hands of the priests. But also, these are the priests. And so they're setting an example of, well, you better be a priest in the way that you are commanded to be a priest, or else you will literally die.
Hmm.
Do you have a different reading?
Well, I did more reading on it because it bothered me so much.
Yeah.
So I have a few things. One is I looked at some commentaries that was like, what did they do wrong? And one of the commentaries said they went before the altar drunk. And it offered some, like, they were judged for being drunk, but more to the point, they were like, they just did it while drunk. And I thought that that was sort of an interesting one. And because just a little bit later, there is a thing that says, drink no wine or other intoxicant, you or your children, when you enter the tent of meeting, that you may not die. This is a law for all time throughout the ages. So to me, this injunction that you have to be careful not to be drunk, and that God didn't say that before, but said it now, and also their offering with fire, I wondered a little bit if this was a, like, God didn't think God had to say this because it was really obvious. And then they like tried to do it while drunk, and that the fire is dangerous and they got burned up. And then afterwards, God was like, you are never allowed to be in here if you have alcohol because you might get burned.
Yeah, fair. Do not try to deep fry a turkey while you're drunk. So can you tell me where this reading is getting the fact that they're drunk from? Is it from the fact that they are admonished not to be drunk after this incident, or?
It is from the fact that they're admonished not to be drunk after the incident.
Okay.
That says, drink no wine when you enter this tent that you may not die. So there, it is extrapolating that perhaps Nadav and Avihu were drunk.
So I have one thing that I would like to mention.
Yeah.
There's a very important clause here. I guess two important clauses.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to attempt to read the Hebrew, but in the Sepharia translation, and they offered before the Lord alien fire, which he had not enjoined upon them.
The thing that they have as alien fire is Esh Zara.
Oh, okay. So man fire?
No, sorry. You're thinking Zachar. This is Zara.
What means Zara?
It has actually a number of different meanings. I went and looked it up, and it can mean lots of different things. So the root is zar. Zara is like the feminine for fire. So it could be a stranger or non-priest or layperson. Like it's non-consecrated fire is how one might think of it. Or sometimes It is used to mean oppressor or enemy or outcast or shunned or loathsome. I wanted to look it up because I wanted to see if it is the same word that it uses for stranger, like when it says you must protect the stranger within your midst, and it's not the same word. That word is ger, and this word is zar.
Yeah, like Gershom from Gershomrain?
I think it is like the stranger here. Sham is here.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, the Sepharia translation says they offered before the Lord alien fire. The NRSV translation says, and they offered unholy fire before the Lord. Basically, the idea is that they did a bad burning, which they were explicitly commanded not to do very recently. Like recently enough that I remember it.
Yes.
And I'm not a priest, so.
Yeah. The other thing that the commentaries I was reading suggested was the problem, and I believe this is Rashi's take on it,
okay,
was it's because they didn't listen to their teacher. Not specifically because they didn't listen to God, but because they didn't listen to Moshe. So not to their father, but specifically because they didn't listen to Moshe. And to me, this could combine with the drunk thing, which is that they didn't let themselves be taught how to do it, and so they didn't know what they were doing. And instead, they came upon it without skills, while intoxicated, and they hurt themselves. And in this case, they died.
Is this a call out for me in this podcast?
No, it is not. It's just saying that, like, maybe sometimes if you're doing dangerous things, you should listen to what people who know more than you are doing. This is instead a call out at people who are doing spring break while there is a pandemic.
Oh my God. Go home. Stop breathing on people and doorknobs. So, yeah, Rashi quotes Rabbi Eliezer saying, Aaron's sons died only because they rendered halachic decisions in the presence of Moshe, their teacher. Which is very funny, the phrasing it specifically as they rendered halachic decisions, rather than emphasizing...
Okay, so I switched the emphasis a little bit, but I got the gist of it.
No, yeah, I love your reading. That seems like a very reasonable and extremely good reading. Thank you. Yeah, so basically, they weren't supposed to do it. They should have listened. They did it anyway. And they died. So Moshe is like, I warned you about stairs, bro. I told you, dog.
No, no, don't do this to me.
Oh, so you did recognize that?
I sure did.
I guess you dated a homestuck, so that'll do it.
I did. That's not why I know it.
Oh. Why are you familiar with Sweepro and Hella, Jeff?
Well, the friend I was mentioning at the top of this episode was very deeply into Homestuck, the one whose birthday it is today. And there was a period of time when we were in our first year of college together, and we were doing things like reading plays together. Like, we would just grab play scripts and, like, read them out loud as, like, our way of connecting with each other. And one time he was like, you know, you could read one of my favorite comics with me. And I was like, uh-huh. And he was like, it'll be a little bit longer due to scripts. And I was like, okay.
Oh, you don't say.
And so I did not get through all of Homestuck due to we were no longer in the same place. He left me. But we did get through a good chunk of the beginning of Homestuck.
How many acts, Jazz? How many acts did you get through of Homestuck?
So I don't remember, but I think we got through 1 through 5.
So you, like, met the trolls? Like, you saw them?
Oh, I sure did.
Okay, wow. So you read a lot of Homestuck.
Okay, by a lot. 6 seems to be bigger than 1 to 5 put together.
Yeah, but no one counts Act 6. If you read the first 5 acts, that counts as having read Homestuck.
Okay, sure. I don't think I met all the trolls. Aren't there new ones that come in partway through 6?
Okay, so they're the beta trolls, who are, like, the ones who are trolling the kids in some time loop shenanigans. But there are also, in order to get to the beta trolls, there was a bad session and they scratched it, and it's a whole thing.
I did meet the first 12 trolls, yes. I think. Yeah.
Cool. Are you telling me that you never had more allegiance with anyone?
Stop.
This is not roasting you. This is roasting me because my best friend that I previously mentioned and I were pale dating for a while and then we're flesh dating for a while.
Oh my God.
And now we both vaguely regret Homestuck for many reasons. And so we're just best friends and not morels.
Great.
I do still text them diamonds when I say I love you.
Cute.
Anyway,
now that we've gone down a thoroughly incomprehensible path to anyone who made better life choices.
Baruch Hashem. So he commands the cousins of Nadab and Abihu to drag the toasted corpses away. And then he says to Aaron and his surviving sons not to mourn because the Israelites are just going to do that for them. But they have to be priests and do all of the mitzvot that they're supposed to. Is that a fair reading?
Yes. Did you skip the bit where Moshe was talking to Aharon about his son's death?
No, that's coming up, because first, the Lord speaks directly to Aaron, saying, drink no wine or other intoxicant, you and your sons, when you enter the Mishkan.
No, before that, like, right after the fire, the Esh Zara came and consumed them. Side note, the Hebrew doesn't have a fancy word for consumed. It's just va to ochal, and that root there is just like, and the fire just ate them. Anyway, then in 10:3, we have, then Moshe said to Aharon, this is what the Eternal meant by saying, through those near to me, I show myself holy and gain glory before all the people.
I did skip. You're right. Yeah.
Although I think glory is an interesting translation there.
What's the word?
The word is ekaved, which is the same root as like kavod, which we have in sort of more modern terms as like respect, but it's also like weight or heaviness.
Okay. So, yeah, I guess I probably shouldn't have skipped this because this says a lot about our relationship to the Eternal, namely that our God is one of the actions of people in many ways.
Say more.
Through those near to me, I show myself holy. The people who follow the commandments, maybe this is specifically about Kohenim, but like the people who follow the commandments are the way that God shows God's glory.
Ooh, yeah. It's almost like the tangible presence of God in the world is connected to the actions of the people.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is definitely a thing we take really seriously.
Yeah, that does get a lot at the concept of the divine that I appreciate in Jewish theology, which is that this is like the God of history and the God of right action.
Yeah, there is a bit in the Talmud, I'll have to see if I can go find it, that I was just reminded of recently, where they say you are not supposed to be in a place where you would need a miracle to happen, because what if the miracle doesn't happen? Then you'd be out of luck.
Yeah.
They're like, if you're on a bridge and it's unstable, don't linger on the bridge because you're like, ah, I'll be fine. Get off the bridge.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah.
Gotta save yourself from the flood.
You do.
Okay. So Hashem speaks directly to Aharon with the laws about intoxicants. This is like another priestly negative mitzvah.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you have about the negative mitzvah, don't drink wine or other intoxicants?
Well, I just had that stuff about how it was connected to maybe it was because they were drunk that they didn't do what they were supposed to, like that they messed up. But I did wonder, I was thinking about it as a little bit of a connection to modernity, how you feel about liquor companies and other drug companies advertising at Pride.
Yeah, that's certainly a thing. It's definitely predatory. Queer people have a higher incidence of alcoholism and extreme smoking than straight people. And that's not an accident.
Right.
And is in fact something capitalized on by the aforementioned companies that advertise at Pride. Yeah, I don't like it. And it also often feels disingenuous. Even the most sincere pitch from a company about like, we really care about you and queer people are a fundamental part of society. That's undercut by the raw churn of profit seeking that the company outside of that specific part of the specific ad department does.
Right.
How did we get on this? Don't be intoxicated in the Mishkan?
Yeah.
Okay.
I recognize that that means I lined up Pride as a similar comparative holy space.
It is a meeting. And has many tents.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the Holy of Holies at Pride?
Ooh.
Is there like a particularly sacred place?
Well, there are additionally restricted areas of Pride.
Okay, say more.
I just mean that when I last went to a Pride thing, which was probably honestly still when I was in San Diego, because I found New York's last year a little overwhelming and didn't go. There are areas that are restricted by like, this one is 18 plus and this one is like only, you know.
Yeah, keeping things holy based on their purpose.
Ooh, what would you say is the Holy of Holy at Pride?
So I don't know that there is a single one, but certainly there is a solemnity to at least in Minneapolis Pride, there's usually like a queer history, especially of AIDS epidemic exhibit that's kind of in the warming house or something, which isn't exactly a warming house in July. June? When is Pride?
June.
I'm a bad guy. June. Okay. But yeah, so like you go into the warming house and you turn right and there's behind some double doors an exhibit where people are at most calmly talking to each other about the contents of the exhibit. And you like walk in a circle and look at all the things about like here are some queer icons from Minneapolis and here's like what was happening during the AIDS crisis and artistic responses and community actions and stuff like that.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah, it is certainly a very solemn and to me holy space.
Do you think you could then further the analogy by saying the similar thing where they were like, and this fancy thing that made it solemn and important that was made by the like wise weavers, is that the AIDS quilt?
There you go.
Yeah.
I love that.
Great. Okay.
So I think another thing though is that there is no specific Holy of Holies because just as we no longer have the Mishkan or the temple, capital M, capital T,
yeah,
there is no center of queer culture. We are all creating our things in response to a diaspora, but also a living apart from and with each other.
I love that. That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Okay, can we keep going?
Absolutely. So after they talk about intoxicants, they discuss exactly which things should be eaten when. And Moshe gets angry because apparently they didn't think to bring the sin offering in and eat it. They just already burned it up. Do you have anything about that?
I don't exactly, but I do have a question for you a little bit, which is the people he gets angry at are Eleazar and Itamar, who are Aharon's sons
remaining
who are still alive.
Sons.
Yeah. So I thought, Drashmaker, Drash me Midrash.
Okay.
What were they thinking and feeling at this moment?
So I think Itamar raised a finger to be like, no, it was Nada, and then just cuts himself off and is like, yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that's my original content here. But I actually read some Midrashim? Drashes?
Yeah, you were good.
Some Rasha Drashes. Because that's the first one and in English. Because after this part, we get into Moshe's chewing them out. And then Aharon is like, hey, this day they brought their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Eternal. And such things have still befallen me. Had I eaten the sin offering today, would the Lord have approved? And Moshe hears this and approves. And so I was like kind of confused about what exactly he was saying there.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I'm reading is like, oh, they did everything right and this is still what happens. How do we recover from that? Do I have to eat the expiation? But when I looked at the commentary, it appears that a lot of it focuses on the fact that Aharon is the high priest and his sons were onanim, like unclean actors. And so, like, even if the high priest isn't ritually cleansed, the eating of the sin offering by the high priest is still valid and cleansing. So this just got increasingly confusing the more I looked up to try and elucidate what was going on.
Yes. I would say that the simplest thing that I found is basically normally Moshe leads and Aharon doesn't. But in this case, Moshe says a thing and Aharon argues with him and advocates for some more gentleness, some more compassion, some more lenience. And Moshe's like, actually, you were right.
And like the way he's doing this is not in the way of the people to this point, which is like, oh, do we really have to do that? It's like, okay, we're doing this within the system. And I don't think that within that system, that's what is warranted.
Yeah.
So that's why in the summary, I said, Aharon argues with Moshe for the first time about halacha, and Moshe is happy about it. Because he's arguing about halacha instead of arguing about the things that they are doing.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I like how Moshe just smiles and is like, thanks for playing in the sacred space with me.
Yeah, it's like a argument for the sake of heaven type deal. Or it's almost like the type of Talmud story we'll get later when Moshe's laughing and going, my brother has defeated me, my brother has defeated me.
Good. So is that from the Talmud on this Parsha?
No, it is a different story from the Talmud. Okay. That is one of my favorite stories on the Talmud. Do you want to hear it?
Yes, please.
Okay, so there is this story. I think it's Rabbi Eliezer. It might be Rabbi Elazar. They just have hard names. I don't... Anyway, there's this one rabbi, and he is arguing against all of these other rabbis. And the thing they're arguing about is a pretty, like... technical matter. It's about whether or not an oven that's broken is pure or impure. And at one point he gets so frustrated because they're about to vote and there's many more of them. And he's like, no. If the halacha is on my side, let the trees prove it. And a tree uproots itself and walks forward a bit. And the rabbis are like, okay, but the halacha is not in the trees. That does not prove it. And he's like, if the halacha is on my side, let the river prove it. And the river, like, stops what it's doing and runs backwards. And the rabbis are like, but the halacha is not in the river. That doesn't prove it. And he's like, well, if the halacha is on my side, let the walls of the Beit Midrash of the House of Study prove it. And the walls of the Beit Midrash, like, start caving in. And one of the other rabbis goes up and yells at the walls. And he's like, there are scholars in here having an argument about Torah. How dare you fall on us and crush them? And the walls stop falling in out of respect. But they don't straighten up out of respect for the other guy. And so they just kind of stay there bent, not taking sides. And then they turn around and they go to him. And they were like, that was dangerous. Don't do that. And also, the halacha is not in the walls. That does not prove it. And he... goes, fine, if the halacha is on my side, let heaven itself prove it. And a bat kol, a heavenly voice, comes down and says, yeah, guys.
Hey, yeah, guys, I'm pretty sure he's right about this.
Yeah.
It's canon.
And one of the other rabbis out of the group of rabbis goes and yells at the heavens and is like, it is not in the heavens. The halacha is here on earth. And the idea being, you have given us the Torah, you've given us the Tanakh, and now it is up to us to interpret what's here. You can't just throw in more later. It's up to us now. And we have decided, we have outvoted this one rabbi, and no matter what he brings separately, it's not in the heavens. The halacha is here on earth.
Yasher koach.
And they win. And God laughs and laughs and says, my children have defeated me. My children have defeated me.
Aww. Yay.
It's beautiful. I love that story.
I'm glad that your version of making obscure Homestuck quotes is making not that obscure Talmud quotes.
Yeah, they're not very obscure, this one.
That's a wonderful story. Thank you.
To be fair, I warned you about stairs, bro, is the least obscure Homestuck quote.
Yeah, but like already there, and also all of the things, all of them is like a thing that Vriska said once. Which I totally thought was textually more important than it was, but I tried looking it up like 4 years ago and nobody had that as a meme, so I don't know.
Okay. Next, can we go on to the halacha of animals?
Yes, please. So instead of laying out just rules for the Kohenim, God lays out rules for the people generally. And it's dividing up amongst land animals and sea animals and sky animals. And Chesed and I actually recorded an episode where we were talking about if space animals would be kosher.
Oh my God, can we make it bonus content?
Yes, I've been intending to edit and release it, but I never got around to that.
Please.
Yes, it's very good content. So those three categories and also swarming things.
Mm-hmm.
So like generally speaking, things of the land and of the water and of the sky are valid to eat unless they... fall into certain categories. Is that fair?
No, I don't accept that as a
summary. No, that's not fair.
Things of all categories include things that are valid to eat and not valid to eat.
Okay, that's fair. So cud chewers with true hooves and hooves that are cloven, you can eat them. And then there are some examples of what doesn't match that.
Right. No rabbits, no pigs, no camels.
No demonim.
I don't know what that is.
Me either.
I do have a question, which is, what, metaphorically speaking, is the difference between an animal with split hooves and one with whole hooves?
Now, I'm a city slicker. Do I look like a particularly savvy cowpoke to you, Jazz?
Let's just move on.
Yeah, so you have the land animals where it's mostly trying to exclude pigs and camels, I think. And so that's why it's like true hooves as opposed to just like weird pointy things and clefts through the hooves. Things that are kosher, that aren't definitely unclean, have those qualities.
Mm-hmm.
So then we talk about things that live in the water, things that have fins and scales you can eat. Jazz, can you think of any examples of things that live in the seas or streams that have no scales?
Yes, these are all of the things I can't eat.
Oh, yeah.
I can't eat snails or octopuses or shrimp or squid.
Catfish?
I don't know about catfish, actually.
Catfish doesn't have scales, and it's a bottom feeder.
So probably not. Or lobster. Yeah, just like lots of things.
Lobsters are also bottom feeders.
Yeah.
Like, the things being excluded here, much like with pigs, are things that eat waste.
Although octopuses don't.
That's fair. But I think that mostly gets caught up in the fact that they live in the seas and don't have scales or fins.
Yep. Sure does.
I don't know why else they would be bad.
Yeah. Although I do feel fine about not eating octopus for the same reason I feel fine about not eating pig, which is that
they're really
both
smart.
Very smart. Yeah.
Yeah. One time Tova and I were at the Milwaukee County Zoo and there was an octopus with like a stumpy leg and we went over to the octopus and we were like, "Hi, check out our limbs." And the octopus was like, which doesn't come across in an audio medium.
No, I don't know what you did.
It was kind of unraveling its limbs and we were just trying to communicate with the octopus.
That's so cute.
It was really cute. I love octopodes.
Okay. There's so many variations on how to pluralize the word octopus, and that's just so not one of them.
Woogim.
I love that, actually.
Yeah, so abominations. Catfish, arthropods, yeah. Just don't eat them.
There is a book that I want to recommend that I have not read. So,
excellent.
Take that as you will.
That is not a unique thing on this podcast.
Sure. It's by a trans Jewish writer named Ogi Takach.
Oh!
I think that is how you pronounce her name, but I'm not like 100% certain. It's a Hungarian name. Anyway, the book is called The Trans Space Octopus Congregation. And it's delightful.
That's so good.
Look, I haven't read it. I've read other pieces of their writing. Their writing is very influenced by all of the different things they are, including Jewish and trans and intersex and autistic. And the thing that I was about to say is that particularly autistic comes through in the like tone and framing and understanding of it. And I don't want to misquote Bogi Takach, but I think he was saying something about it having a more communal and therefore like also Jewish sensibility, but also communicating in a really different way from the way that humans did. And that he really liked that idea of like a totally different type of communication. Anyway.
Right. So birds, the ones that are poisonous are bad. Wait, I guess that's not in this chapter.
There's a bunch of birds that you can't eat, especially ones that eat dead things.
Oh, yes. Hey, that makes sense. And then it's like, all winged swarming things that walk on fours shall be an abomination for you, but you can eat a couple of things. You know, jointed leg leapers and locusts and grasshoppers.
Yeah, I just want to throw in a couple of things because we've, I think, mentioned the word abomination a couple times in English. And I think sometimes people have this association of abomination and Leviticus with that thing that comes up in Achrimot and in a few parshot about gay people. This is not the same word. The word they use here are shekets.
Mm.
The word they're going to use over there is toeva. It's a different type of deal. They are different words.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
So basically, if you touch carcasses, you're unclean, and therefore you have to wash your clothes and just, like, be unclean, ritually speaking, until evening. Also, all animals that walk on paws. Oh, interesting. Well, okay, so a lot of this is about touching carcasses rather than necessarily touching the animals themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you can technically, halachically touch dogs. Don't touch rodents or lizards. Okay, so anything on which one of the unclean things falls when they're dead will be unclean, whether it's like wood, cloth, skin, sack. You gotta like dip it in water and just let it be unclean until evening.
Yes.
And like we've heard previously, if they contaminate an earthen vessel, in this case, it's not like the blood makes it holy, it's that the corpse makes it unholy, then you gotta just...
Unholy is a little bit of a strong word.
Okay.
But yes.
Unclean.
It's just like, yeah, it's got some impurity.
Well, when I say unholy, I'm thinking about holy as meaning like set apart and consecrated to a specific task. And so if something is unholy, it is unconsecrated and no longer valid for ritual purposes, basically.
I guess that's fair. I was just thinking about it as like my association with the word unholy is like different than the word like impure, because impure, whatever. You can have an impure metal and that just means it's like not of as high a quality or whatever. But unholy is like the unholy spawn of Satan, which seems like a little bit different from the associations of like, it's just an alloy.
See, I should have that association, especially considering that I listened to a Buffy the Vampire Slayer rewatch podcast. But no, mostly I'm just thinking about halacha.
Aw, cute.
Yeah, thank you. So, yeah, basically, you break the vessel if it's made out of clay or whatever. As to any food that may be eaten, it shall become unclean if it came in contact with water. As to any liquid that may be drunk, it shall become unclean if it was inside any vessel. And I'm not sure about the antecedents here. If it's just saying, like, any food that is, like, submerged in water for a while, or any potable liquid that's, like, sitting out in a vessel is unclean, or if it's specifically one into which unclean water or one of those unclean vessels, you know?
Yes, there is a deeply technical explanation
of
when specifically something is impure and unclean and under what conditions and whether it can be purified or not purified that takes place in some of Masechet Shabbat in the Talmud that I was studying in the Daf, and you can go read it. It starts on like the 13th or 14th Daf and continues for a little bit. I don't want to go into it. It's like long and technical and boring.
Yeah.
The Talmud is great and not boring, but but the specific nitty gritty of if you touch it on this particular place versus if you touch it on the inside and also the air that surrounds it, and also is it made of glass or is it made of earth, and also what degree of impurity are you when you're touching it, and it's just like a lot.
I don't know. All of this just seems like good food prep. Like if a rat is in the bucket of water and dead, if that water splashes on your food, don't eat it, you know?
Yeah.
If a fly just like drops bodily into the mug of water that you're drinking, maybe pour that out.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So anything that comes in direct contact with a carcass is unclean. You smash an oven or stove. I guess this is the part where Hashem was intervening. Interestingly enough, a spring or cistern in which water is collected shall be clean.
Hmm.
Which, like, a cistern involves standing water, right? That's like a well, basically?
I think so.
So that's interesting, and I don't love that. A spring at least makes sense because that's flowing water.
Yeah. A cistern might mean that it's made by humans.
Okay, yeah.
Because, like, we do have lots of other things when you put it into practice, when you move to sort of Talmudic commentary, where they're talking about the way you purify things involve often a mikveh, and a mikveh does have to be moving water, but it can also be created by humans, so, like...
Cool. So, yeah, if the carcass falls upon some seed grain that you're going to sow later, that doesn't matter, the seed grain is fine. But if the seed could possibly be germinating and any part of the carcass touches it, it's unclean. You can't then grow that.
Mm.
Even if you can eat the animal, anyone who touches its carcass is unclean and has to wash and just be unclean until evening.
Mm.
Don't eat swarming things. God's telling you that.
Yeah, and then it sort of ends with, this is all of the instructions concerning animals. I wanted to highlight one last thing before we wrapped up.
Yes, please.
Which is, there's this word, sheretz, And that is like a particular kind of animal that is like a creepy, crawly, maybe reptilian thing.
Oh.
And it is an inherently unkosher animal, inherently impure by what's laid out in the Torah. But then in Sanhedrin 17a,
yeah,
in the Talmud, we have this... Okay, it doesn't have vowels, so I am going to try and read the Hebrew, but then I'm going to translate it for you. It says, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. So Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, in...
Ein Moshevin B'Sanhedrin, and that's as far as we got in the Svara session. Keep going.
Yes, yes. Ein Moshevin B'Sanhedrin, ele min she yodea letahar et... Hasheretz min haTorah.
Yeah.
Do you remember what it means?
Yeah, it's Rav Yehuda is quoting his friend Rav, who said that one shouldn't be seated in the Sanhedrin unless they can call a crawling thing clean, which is basically like particularly wise people, the people who you want determining what is or isn't the law, should be able to find the holiness in even the least holy things, was my outside reading on that.
I really enjoyed that reading. My outside reading of it would have been, you can only place on the Sanhedrin, which are the people who have authority over everything, including people's lives sometimes and sometimes deaths, you can only render them there. You're only fit to make that kind of determination over somebody's life and death if you can do something that is literally impossible just by force of will. And out of the voice of your reason, you can say that something that is inherently impure, you can make it pure by reasoning. And that this is, in some respects, an argument that nobody deserves to be on the Sanhedrin and nobody deserves to have that kind of power.
In the words of Kanye West, who certainly should not be put in any sort of political power, no one man should have all that power.
Yeah. Anyway.
So that's the Parsha.
So that's the Parsha.
Oh, dear Lord, we're at an hour and 20 minutes recording.
We sure are. So let's wrap up. It is time for Rating God's Writing, the segment in which we pick two scales and rate the Parsha based on it. Lulav, out of... 4 kosher hooves, 4 true hooves. How many hooves would you rate this Parsha?
I would rate this Parsha 4 hooves, because I like to see somebody being made an example of. And, sorry, don't put me in power either. Yeah, so the stuff with Nadab and Abihu was hilarious and also sad. But it's just funny to see the, like, family dynamics of Moshe being like, okay, so you're not going to do that again, right?
Oh, you really enjoyed the return to even a tiny bit of story.
That's it. Yeah. Okay, I see. Yep, that's definitely what I was going for here. And also just, like, this is a very important part in determining kashrut.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's literally about what things are clean and unclean.
Yeah.
Yeah. 4 kosher hooves. Jazz, out of 100 scales that you stripped from something from the sea which you may eat, how many scales would you rate this Parsha?
I would rate it 82 scales.
Okay.
I thought it was pretty good. I think it's got lots of room for interesting interpretations about authority and strangers and purity and what you can consume and how you make decisions and family stuff, mm-hmm, and like lots of ways to read into stuff, and I appreciate that. But I felt bad for Nadav and Avihu.
Yeah.
And I didn't think Moshe handled that very well and was a very good uncle. Yeah, I don't know. And also, I am very connected to this bit of, like, what you can eat and what you cannot eat, but I wish it felt like it had more going for it beyond the literal, this is how you do safe food preparation, even though I think safe food preparation is very good and important.
Yeah, excellent. Thanks for parsing. Can you take us to the close?
Yes. Thanks for listening to Kosher Queers. If you like what you've heard, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/kosherqueers, which will give you bonus content and help us keep making this for you. We would really appreciate it. You can also follow us on Twitter at Kosher Queers or like us on Facebook at Kosher Queers, or email us your questions, comments, and concerns at kosherqueers@gmail.com. And please spread the word about our podcast. I think we are a good and useful resource for people who are very online at the moment.
As you may be able to tell from all the Homestuck we were talking about this episode.
Our artwork is by the talented Lior Gross. Our music is courtesy of the fabulous band Brivola, whose work you can find on Bandcamp. Go buy their album. They're great. Our sound production this week is done by our excellent audio editor, Ezra Faust.
Our full transcripts, as with every episode, are done by Deco and Jazz, and definitely accessible through our episode descriptions on Buzzsprout.
I'm Jazz Twersky, and you can find me at WordNerdKnitter on Twitter. I'm recording in a different place than usual, so this week I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Ohlone people, who were all over the Bay Area where I am now, and California was, before colonization, one of the most linguistically diverse places on the planet, with all sorts of different languages spoken by all sorts of different peoples who lived up along this coastline in all sorts of places and sometimes were in contact with each other and connection, much of which was taken away by the process of colonization. So the Ohlone people definitely still exist and live in this region, and I will link to some resources of how to support them.
Heck yeah. I'm Lula Varno, and you can find me at SpaceTruck6 on Twitter, or yell at me at PalmLiker. I recorded this audio on the traditional lands of the Wapekute and Anishinaabeg, who also still exist. Have a lovely queer Jewish day!
This week's gender is eccentric relative of dubious provenance.
This week's pronouns are Fancourt and Babberley.